forward, I think.
Okay. You ready?
Go ahead.
A couple of months ago, Dr. Dennis of the Horticultural Department was a visitor at our house in Winter Park, Florida, and asked me to make some comments about events and individuals connected with the horticulture of an earlier generation. I did so, but it occurs to me now as I'm sitting at L.H. Bailey's old desk in the new horticultural building that perhaps there are a few things that I omitted that might well be said. I shall try to omit comments on the people that I talked about in an earlier recording. First, a word about some of the outstanding teachers of horticulture of an earlier day. First, a word about L.H. Bailey. L.H. Bailey has long been known as the Dean of American Horticulture, and he was an outstanding teacher, though personally I never had any courses under him. He belongs to an earlier generation. But Bailey developed the men who shaped horticulture in the United States in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and perhaps early 90s. Much of the horticultural development of that era was due to men whom Bailey trained. He truly classifies as the dean of all-time American horticulture. A word about U.P. Hedrick. Hedrick was a graduate of this institution and then became horticulturist and finally director of the New York Geneva Agricultural Experiment Station. Hedrick was an outstanding teacher. Men who had work under him knew him as thorough, as friendly, and as a man who knew how to teach. He developed a number of the men in a generation later than Bailey who helped shape American horticulture as we know it today.
Can I interrupt here? Did you have Hedrick as a teacher yourself?
Oh, yes.
Do you remember anything particular about him in class as to inspiration and so on?
No, I don't know as I do. I don't know as I do.
As being a very good teacher.
I don't know as I do. Now a word about John W. Crist. Crist was a teacher of horticulture during the earlier days of my own administration. I meet week after week and month after month many of the former students who had work under Crist. Invariably, they mentioned to me the fact that of all the instructors they ever had at Michigan State, if not in all of the institutions which they attended, John Crist as the outstanding teacher. He knew how to stimulate students, a fact that is evident from because many graduate students in field crops, soils, and related subjects came over to the horticultural building and took Crist courses. They didn't take the courses that other fellows we had gave, not because they weren't good, but because Crist's were better. They were really outstanding. He deserves a lot of credit for developing men that currently are leading men in the horticultural professional field of today. I'll mention one incident that may need purging. But it's an interesting incident. I never knew anything about it until a couple of months ago, when I received a letter from a professor of landscape architecture in one of the Western institutions, who was here in the late 20s and early 30s for graduate work. Then he went on to Harvard and took an advanced courses in landscape architecture. This letter, which is the first I had had from this fellow in many years, was reminiscing, and he recalled a course that he took under Crist when he was here in the late 20s or early 30s. It was the time when the so-called Scopes trial was on in Tennessee. Williams Jennings Bryan was the attorney for the accusing side. Clarence Darrow of Chicago was the defender of Scopes. The trial was on and at its hottest when, according to this fellow that wrote the letter to me a couple of months ago, said that right after the class convened under Crist, Crist made this remark about Williams Jennings Bryan, who was the accuser in the Scopes trial. That fellow never had a new meristematic cell in his damned head for the last 50 years. Now a word about more recent men. I want to say a word about H.B. Tookie. Tookie didn't do too much teaching himself, but he had a group of men around him that between them did an outstanding job. And Tookie and his men in the last 15 or 20 years have done for horticulture, professional horticulture, much of what Bailey did in an earlier day. In other words, many of the young leaders in the horticultural field today had graduate training under Tookie and his men. And Tookie deserves a lot of credit for being a good teacher and a good administrator of teaching methods and teaching work. Now just a word about a few men who are connected with the horticultural department of earlier days, not so much from the standpoint of their teaching, although indirectly it was a part of their teaching. I refer to the influence they had on the development of horticulture, on the contacts they made with the industries, horticultural industries of the state and of the nation. First, let me say a word about Eustace. Eustace trained a group of men that went out into the commercial field and became leaders in the merchandising, advertising phases of horticulture. And today, much of the horticultural products of America are sold, merchandised, advertised, as the case may be, by men whom Eustace trained. He had influence in making contacts between the Horticultural Department of Michigan State and the horticultural selling industries of the country. I want to say a word about Taft. I never had courses to Taft, but I became acquainted with him because he was a resident of East Lansing for a number of years after I came here. I think one of my professional friends put the case of Taft very succinctly when he said, Taft had, or at that time he was still living, has wonderful judgment. He's able to size up situations. He is able to reach conclusions that the rank and file of people don't reach. Us other fellows in the field respect Taft for the leadership that he furnished to the horticultural industry in the way of sound advice, sound judgments. I want to say a word next about Charles Woodbury and Charles Mahoney. Woodbury was a graduate in horticulture of this institution, and then his professional contacts later on were at Purdue University. Mahoney was a graduate of one of the Western institutions, Texas, I think. Then he came to this institution and was a staff member in the vegetable field for a number of years. Both became associated with the National Canners Association after leaving Michigan State. Both had an important part in making contacts between Michigan State Horticultural Department and, as a matter of fact, other departments in the institution and the processing industries of the country. They did a lot to help Michigan horticulture and national horticulture through their contacts and ability to work with men in the horticultural processing field. I think that perhaps enough with regard to former horticulturists with which I have been associated or acquainted. Now let me say a word about other men on the staff of Michigan State who had an important part in the research field. At the head of that list, I place Ezra Krauss. Krauss did more than any other man I can think of connected with Michigan State or with any other institution of the country in putting horticulture on a truly scientific basis. While his work along this line was done while he was connected with the Oregon station and later on the Wisconsin station, he was responsible for giving the people in the industry and the people in the professional field an insight of how plants are influenced by the various factors of environment. And I doubt if there's any individual whose published work is cited more than that of Krauss in connection with professional advancement of horticulture. I want to say a word about a couple of other men, not in horticulture, but on the staff of Michigan State while I was likewise on the staff. First, I want to say a word about Malcolm Trout. I classify Malcolm Trout as one of the outstanding men in the field of dairy research for all time. I put Malcolm Trout of Michigan and Louis Pasteur of France as the two men who've done most to advance the interests of the dairy industry of the world. I want to say a word about George Brown. George Brown, for many years, was the head of the animal husbandry department of this institution. George Brown was not an academic man. He was a good teacher, yes. But above all, he was a man of sound judgment. When I had a puzzling matter come up that I wanted an unbiased, shrewd opinion about, I could go to George Brown, lay the case before him, he'd size the situation up, and he'd tell me what he thought about it, and what he thought about it was generally right. George Brown was a man of sound judgment, a man who was valuable to the institution. Now, just a word about C.F. Huffman. Of course, everyone knew him as Shorty. Shorty was one of the outstanding men in the field of dairy production, not only in this institution, but in the entire country. I doubt if there's any man ever connected, I know there was no man ever connected with this institution in the field of dairy production, and I doubt if there's any man ever connected with any other institution in the field of dairy production whose advice was and comment was more sought after than that of Shorty Huffman. He was really an outstanding dairy production worker. I think that's all.
You haven't spoken about Beale.
Oh, yes. I should say a word about Dr. Beale. Dr. Beale, of course, is one of the pioneers on the staff of this institution. I was fortunate in having had a couple of courses under him while I was a student here back between 1901 and 1905. I'll relate two little incidents about him. Perhaps they're not important, but they give an insight into the man. In the laboratories that he had under his charge, when he was handling the laboratory work, he'd pass around from desk to desk where we fellows were working. I say working. We were looking at specimens that were given to us, and we didn't see what was there. He'd come around, look over our shoulder, get an idea of what we found in the specimens that we were given to size up. And a favorite expression of his was, "Keep on squinting, keep on squinting." Well, it is pretty good advice. Generally, if we kept on squinting long enough, we saw what was there to be seen. That isn't so important that we saw what we should have seen when he told us to keep on squinting. But he taught his students to keep on squinting in other courses and in other work and through life. And it was all fired good advice. I'll relate another incident about old Doc Beale. He was a good teacher. But he'd get into something of a rut like all the other teachers do. And he was quite inclined every now and then in the course of a lecture that he was giving to tell a joke. Well, in the course of an hour's lecture, you might have a half a dozen jokes. And we students got the idea that some of these jokes were old-time jokes. We'd heard some of them before, and we were pretty sure he had used some of them before. So one time we passed the word around that no one would chuckle or give a snort or even crack a smile at a single joke that he told in class. Well, he told one of his jokes fairly early in that particular hour. We all were sober and silent as mummies, not a single response. Well, he turned back to his notes that he was lecturing from, went on 5, 6, 7 minutes, told another joke. Not a smile to say anything of a chuckle in response. That went on a third time, and finally a fourth time. And our responses were the same. We were doing our stuff. He pulled his glasses down to the end of his nose, looked over them, looked at the glass, and this was a remark. I've told that joke at this point for 30 years, and I always got a good laugh from it. And what's the matter with you fellows? Then we gave him a good cheer. That's enough.
Well, no, I think you became head of the department in 1922.
Right.
And director of the train station about 1925.
28.
So you were director and head at the same time. Now,
up until sometime in the early 40s, when I gave up my horticultural work and devoted all my time to station work. And Dr. Tukey came on as...
Now today, we consider that a very burdening job, to be both director and head. How did you manage to do all that?
Well, I really didn't manage. I was a fool to take it on. I should have insisted on taking only one or the other. But at that time, the institution was in financial straits. Shaw was president, and he was trying to save money. And he thought it would be a money-saving deal to combine the two things. Well, Shaw made a mistake, and I made a big one.
So it was really his decision. You could have said no, I suppose.
I could have said no, yes. But foolishly, I didn't.
Now, you became director of the experiment station just about time for the market crash.
Yes.
There were lots of agricultural problems before the crash.
Yes.
Now, how did you manage to, when we talk about problems with funding research today, what were the problems in funding research then, and how did you manage to scrape up enough money to operate the experiment station?
Well, a dollar was worth more then. A lot more than it was now. And we had to be extremely cautious about expending money. We got along as best we could. That's the way I'll put it. We just got along as best we could. We could have done better if we'd had more funds, but no one's to blame for that.
How much support did you get from grower organizations? Today we got quite a little money from grower organizations. One purpose or another. Is that true then?
At that time, I don't know as we got any grower subsidies at all. I don't think we did. We did get some scholarship grants from organizations. I remember we got one from the National Pickle Packers Association. And we got one from what was at that time the Kalamazoo Vegetable Parchment Company, and from several other concerns. But those were industry or organization grants rather than individual persons grants.
I think I asked you once about the building, but that was between 28 and 32.
Yes.
The horticulture building.
Yes.
And you were department head and director then. Did any problems arise in building this building? That was after the crash, and it seems as if there might have been financial problems there.
No, I don't think so. At that time, the horticultural industries of the state were sort of up in arms about not getting the service they expected from the institution. And they were in here every now and then at the president's office or contacting members of the Board of Agriculture, as it was known at that time, about their not getting the service they wanted. And so they put on quite a lot of pressure. And I think it was that pressure that got us the building for one thing.
Now, you were in the original building
here,
the one at Liberty High.
A couple of years, yeah.
Designed.
Yeah.
Before he moved into here.
Yeah.
So this was quite a jump in terms of space.
Oh yes. And it was badly needed.
Uh, who else? I assume there are other departments in with you then, were there?
No.
Just horticulture?
Just horticulture.
So food science split off later. It started out as a...
That split off later, yes.
And who began? Did Roy Marshall begin that work on food science, or was it...
No, it came later than his time. And I don't recall who was the prime mover in that, but they took over food processing and food science work from horticulture, dairy husbandry, animal husbandry, poultry husbandry. Mm-hmm. It was quite a general reorganization.
When you became head of the department, what was there here in terms of orchard facilities or vegetable facilities and so on?
Well, the building now where the old Olin Medical Center stands, and everything to the
east
of that building, and the horticultural building, out as far as present dairy building, clear out to the eastern confines of the present campus, was given over to vegetable gardens and orchards.
So
that was our outside laboratory.
Now what was, let's say, south of Mount Hope on campus at that point?
Well, that was privately owned farmland.
Well, that was bought later.
That was bought later, quite a lot later.
I thought that all belonged to the university. So the university properties were all this side of Mount Hope. And when did the orchard go in?
The new orchard?
Yeah, the new orchard. Was that while you were director? Was that after Tukey came?
No, that went in before, but I can't give you the date. Mm-hmm. I can't give you the date on that.
Now, you're the senior author on one of the classics as a textbook in horticulture.
Fundamentals of Food Production, yeah.
Could you tell me a little about what went into that? Because I would think it would have taken you 10 years to accumulate the data.
Well, I don't know as it took us 10 years, but Bradford, Hooker, and I are all staff members in the Department of Horticulture, University of Missouri at that time. And we all recognized that what was available at that time in the way of textbooks for fruit growing were very inadequate. And we decided that we'd undertake to write one. We divided up the field. I took certain sections, Bradford took certain sections, and Hooker took certain sections. We put in a lot of time on it, on our own, and finally got it in shape and got publication.
When was the first edition published?
I think the first edition came out in 1922, the fall that I came
in. I hadn't realized it was that early.
Yeah.
So then you revised it between then and 1922.
There's been several revisions, yes.
Several revisions.
Yeah. Hooker died, and Bradford was so tied up with his new job that he took with the USDA that I had to do all the work for revising it several times.
But how did you manage to do it and maintain the work that you were doing as director of the experiment station, head of the department?
Well, of course, the first edition is out. Well, the first edition was written. We did the work when we were all staff members at the University of Missouri.
Uh-huh.
And then later on, I just had to take time out, work nights on it, so on.
It was a matter of revision. The first edition, so it was not as difficult as writing it all over.
That's right, but I had to bring it down to date.
We hear today a lot about organic gardening, and essentially in the early 1900s, a lot of farmers were organic gardeners because they weren't out spraying trees. Taft introduced spraying, but I presume that doesn't necessarily mean that growers started doing a lot of spraying right away. But how do you see this current thought on organic gardening compared to the situation then and how it relates to it?
Oh, it's all right. But you'll take a broad scale look, far range look at things. From the standpoint of our citrus and deciduous fruit industries, from the standpoint of most of our vegetables, from tropical and subtropical stuff like citrus and bananas and coffee and tea and all those things, organic gardening is just a drop in the bucket. Not that it isn't of some importance. I think it is probably of growing importance. But it's small potatoes beside the horticultural industry in a broad way.
Well, I'm thinking of the fact that growers were organic gardeners in 1900. They weren't out spraying their trees, I assume.
Oh, they weren't out spraying their trees, but back in those days, as evidenced by what they talked about when they had their horticultural society meetings, they talked about varieties and they talked about fertilizers. Those are the two big topics. Then pest control came in as probably the most important, more important. And of course, that's continued as very important right up to the present time. And then gradually some other things came in. Methods of cold storage, methods of controlled temperature storage, and then still later here, of course, the hot thing today is growth regulators. All over the world, that's the hot thing in horticulture. For instance, pardon me if I give you a personal illustration. I'm still doing professional work. Currently, I'm doing it for Dow Chemical Company. A lot of it. I've been at it for a number of years. For 3 years, I've been on studying, working by myself on this. Develop a material that sprayed on trees will retard the development, slow it down so that they won't blossom until a week, 10 days, 2 weeks later. If they blossom a week later, you avoid half the injury. If you blossom 2 weeks later, you can avoid practically all of it. As I say, I began that work 2 weeks, 2 years. This is the third year. And I think I've got it. Now that's just one facet of the growth regulator business, such as Bukovac is leading in the country today. Of course, he's not working on that particular project, but he's working on other growth regulating problems, and a lot of other people in other institutions are. Last time we had a world around the world trip, I remember a conference I had with the horticulturists at the University of Hawaii. And one of their top flight men there was working on growth regulators. Entirely different matter.
What you're saying, I think, is that probably is the most important area of research in horticulture today.
Right now. Now, it's going to be in 1977 or 80? No telling.
But you're convinced that growth regulators will become available to do what we want to do with fruit crops.
Become available to do a lot of things. Theoretically, any process can be regulated by the right chemical or the right procedure. But practically, well, I put it this way. A lot of the research work in horticulture, as in other fields today, is of a strictly academic nature. It's research work. Maybe it's good research work. But what application it will have to industry, a lot of it is very doubtful. And you know what I think I'm talking bluntly and frankly to you? The men responsible for that are not the poor devils of students who are given the problems to work on, but it's the administrators who are assigning them problems, recommending them problems, then giving them a little assistance and direction, help as they go along. But I blame the administrators as not furnishing today the leadership in some of these fields that they ought to furnish. Now, for instance, where is Bukovac getting any leadership? He's on his own, doing a good job. But I think they need some good leadership, not only in horticultural research, but in field crops and in dairying, poultry husbandry, and so on.
Well, you raise a point, though. It sounds to me as if you're saying that were you a department head today, you would be suggesting problems to your staff members.
I'm saying today that I ought to be doing that. But maybe what I would be doing is what the rest of them are doing.
Well, I was going to throw the question back in your lap and say, what did you do as a department head?
Not too much. No, as I look back upon it, I wish now that I had years and years ago some of the perspective that I've been accumulating. Tukey was having been one of them. That's one thing I can say for Tukey.
That you felt that
he has had vision. Yes.
Staff members as to where were the critical areas.
He has had, put it, rare vision. Now, Carew, my contacts with him have been so fragmentary and limited. He may be a better man than Tukey in that, in respect. I don't know.
Well, tell me now, Tukey, tell me what he did to direct the research program of the department. How did he do it?
I don't know as I can tell you. But from the results, I think he did a good job. For one thing, he gathered around him some outstanding men extremely few of these other institutions can match at the present time. Now, don't take this down. I'm going to make a blunt statement.